Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this Turning Towards Life with me, Lizzie, and the lovely Justin. We are here again for our 96th week of Turning Towards Life. And we have this wonderful source by Alain de Botton this week that Justin's chosen. I'm in the wilds of Tenerife, so you can see behind me some large rocks, maybe, where I'm right by the ocean. And Justin's in the wilds of Cornwall. So we are both ocean bound today, which is quite extraordinary that we can do this from these different places. And so, we're just very happy, as always, to be here and to be reflecting on something meaningful for us. And you're very welcome here, whether you're listening on a podcast or you're listening live or you're catching up later. Thank you very, very much for being with us. We very much appreciate that anybody joins us for these things at all. So the miracle of you being here is very, very wonderful. So yeah, we're gonna begin with this reading in a second, but we wanted to mention just at the beginning that Justin is going to be teaching on the 23rd and 24th of September our Coaching Foundations program, our Third Space Coaching Foundations program in London. So if you would like to have a bit more of an understanding of the work that we do in our one-to-one work, and also the programs that we run, it's an amazing chance to really get a taster of this kind of work. It's called Integral Development Coaching. And Justin's going to be there for 2 days, bringing this wisdom and way of being in the world to a small group of people in London. So if you're interested, check out our website, which is wearethirdspace.org. And we have a lovely new website as well that still is new by about a few months, and it's very beautiful. So anyway, check it out because it's very, very lovely and we love it. What else is there to say? I think that's enough on the announcement side. And maybe we just delve in and say hello to Justin as well.
Yes, I'm going to say good morning to everybody. Morning, Lizzie. Morning, everybody. I'm in awe at what technology makes possible, I have to say, this morning. So I am sitting on a small beach on the South Cornish coast in a tiny little village that has 3 houses, a pub and a restaurant, and an amazing stretch of sand. And I was swimming here yesterday. Absolutely beautiful. And we can do this. I can sit at the tables outside, and mobile technology makes it possible for us to do this. And I think it's really extraordinary. And so here we are. This is Turning Towards Life from the seaside, from both Lizzie and I. We've never quite done this before, on different parts of the world. And here's this source, which is one that I've chosen this week. I'm just going to say the tiniest bit of background about it. Lizzie, you and I have often talked about when we've been in difficulty with, we've been talking about difficulties in relationships that we've had, about what it might be to see the person who we're judging, to remember that they were once very, very, very tiny. And I find myself caught up both professionally in some, with some groups of people that I'm trying to support, and also again and again in my own life with this sort of feeling of being gripped by the certainty that someone else is, I don't know, out to get me or wrong, or all of those kind of very harsh and strong judgments that we so easily get thrown into. And this is an excerpt, it's a couple of excerpts put together from Alain de Botton's wonderful book, The Course of Love, which has so much to say about what that's wise and kind about what it is to be in relationship with other human beings. So here, I'm going to read it first. I'm reading the wrong thing. I'm reading what I've written. I need to read.
Ooh, can you read us that too?
Yeah. I need to read what Alain has written. Mm-hmm. When children cry, we don't accuse them of being mean or self-pitying. We wonder what has upset them. When they bite, we know they must be frightened or momentarily vexed. We are alive to the insidious effects that hunger, a tricky digestive tract, or a lack of sleep may have on mood. How kind we would be if we managed to import even a little of this instinct into adult relationships, if here too we could look past the grumpiness and viciousness and recognize the fear, confusion, and exhaustion which almost invariably underlie them. This is what it would mean to gaze upon the human race with love. Because it's not just children who are childlike. Adults too are, beneath the bluster, intermittently playful, silly, fanciful, vulnerable, hysterical, terrified, and pitiful, and in search of consolation and forgiveness. We are well versed at seeing the sweet and the fragile in children and offering them help and comfort accordingly. Around them, we know how to put aside the worst of our compulsions, vindictiveness and fury. We can recalibrate our expectations and demand a little less than we normally do. We're slower to anger and a bit more aware of unrealized potential. We readily treat children with a degree of kindness that we are oddly and woefully reluctant to show to our peers. It is a wonderful thing to live in a world where so many people are nice to children. It would be even better if we lived in one where we were a little nicer to the childlike sides of one another.
When children cry, we don't accuse them of being mean or self-pitying. We wonder what has upset them. When they bite, we know they must be frightened or momentarily vexed. We are alive to the insidious effects that hunger, a tricky digestive tract, or a lack of sleep may have on mood. How kind we would be if we managed to import even a little of this instinct into adult relationships. If here too we could look past the grumpiness and viciousness and recognize the fear, confusion, and exhaustion, which almost invariably underlie them. This is what it would mean to gaze upon the human race with love. Because it is not just children who are childlike. Adults too are, beneath the bluster, intermittently playful, silly, fanciful, vulnerable, hysterical, terrified, and pitiful, and in search of consolation and forgiveness. We're well versed at seeing the sweet and fragile in children and offering them help and comfort accordingly. Around them, we know how to put aside the worst of our compulsions, vindictiveness, and fury. We can recalibrate our expectations and demand a little less than we normally do. We're slower to anger and a bit more aware of unrealized potential. We readily treat children with a degree of kindness that we are oddly and woefully reluctant to show our peers. It's a wonderful thing to live in a world where so many people are nice to children. It would be even better if we lived in one where we were a little nicer to the childlike sides of one another.
You know, the word which really got me, Lizzie, as you were reading, is bluster. Mm-hmm. And he says, beneath the bluster, we're playful, silly, fanciful, vulnerable, hysterical, terrified, and pitiful, and in search of consolation and forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And that felt really right to me, that a lot of the time when we get into difficulty with one another, what's mostly going on is bluster, and even worse if both of us are engaged in bluster. And I think what bluster means here is the cover-up that we do, you know, to not let on that I'm terrified, or to not let on that I'm hurting, or to not let on that I'm confused, or I'm hysterical, or I'm, you know, terrified. Instead, all of that, maybe the big thing that we do that leads to this whole condition that Alan is talking about, is that as we grow from being children to adults, we learn to get involved, we learn to put on a great big cover story. And the cover story has two really big consequences. So one is, it's very difficult for other people and often for ourselves to know how we really are. And so what other people are responding to is the cover story, is the bluster. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, you know, maybe it's no wonder that we end up in this circumstance that he's talking about, where we can, you know, there are many people who treat children with great sweetness and care, and I know any of us sometimes can treat children horribly too, But this point that he's making, that with children very often, if we find the goodness and kindness in ourselves, we see what's going on more readily. And perhaps we end up in this situation because we as adults are so readily engaged in a great big cover-up that we're all complicit is the way to say it, in losing contact with, oh, actually behind this display of whatever it is that I'm now finding so uncomfortable and that I'm having a great big reaction to is a kind of sweet, innocent, hurt being. But we're covering it. See, this is the thing I'm starting to see. Because so many of us cover it up in ourselves, of course, we end up engaged in this great big dance of distance from one another. So Alan's call that we treat one another with seeing behind the surface, also, I think, I can see calls on us to see what we can do when we can to let go of the bluster so that we can actually be seen. That gives other people much more of a chance to meet the hurt, vulnerable, tender part of us in any dispute or disagreement or difficulty.
Yeah. Justin, your mic's rubbing on your zip a little bit. So what I'm really resonating with as you're talking, Justin, is like the more we're in our own bluster, it doesn't matter whether someone's an adult or a child, we'll still be not connected to the part of them that's the beneath part. And as adults, we can relate in this way, like practice relating in this way, and it might serve us better with our children as well. And I feel really, I don't know whether Alain de Botton would agree with me, but I think our children bring up often far worse stuff than our friends or peers in terms of our own process. And that maybe there's also a way of turning this around, like our peers and our friends and our colleagues are great practice grounds for how to treat our children with a greater degree of kindness than we might just without any consciousness of what we're doing. And I remember inquiring when I was little as to why we were mean to people around us who were close, but then we'd get all kind of behaved and sociable and well behaved as soon as somebody knocked on the door that wasn't inside our family. And I've always found it really weird, like, okay, so the people who have to be polite to in society get the best of my attention, get the version of me that's amenable, and then the door closes and then we all start shouting at each other or something. And I feel like this invitation for me in this and what you're saying, Justin, is what if I can, adult to adult, practice seeing behind the scenes so that that serves my relationship with other people who are grown-ups, as it were. But also, how might that allow me to then tune into the often much more wild and expressive and non-socialisedness of the children around me as well? And so it sounds like Alan's onto things much more than maybe many of us, where you could maybe look to hunger or if biting is happening, it's because they're frightened or something. But I'm pretty sure there's lots of people who don't see it like that already. And I think it's when we're triggered, it's really hard to be in contact with ourselves and that part of someone else that has something going on beneath. And we just think, I'm so ashamed my child bit another child or something. And we can't see beneath that. It's hard for us to see beneath our own stuff to the reasons for things and the way that we could remedy things that aren't maybe obvious in our own reactivity. And I guess I'm just appreciating this, how we can be a practice ground for one another and see how that impacts on the way that we feel about anyone of any age and any part of the constellation that we find ourselves in. And I can't help but think about all the children in the world at the moment who are being treated horribly, really horribly. And I don't think anyone's being nice to the little children on the borders in Mexico and the States. Like, and it's a really hard thing to see and feel. And the world, I think the world really, yeah, need to hear the this thing about what's beneath and what's behind, so that we're not just taking things at face value or as in the bluster, as Alan says.
I'm having to remember to unmute myself, Lizzie, because of the wind. I'm not sure whether the sound in my mic is the wind blowing or it brushing against things. So you can let me know. Yes, I felt that too in reading this piece, that of course Alan makes a claim here that it's ordinary for us to see the sweetness in children, and there are many, many times when we don't. You know, when we're as confused with children as we are with adults, we misinterpret. But what I do appreciate here is his pointing into the possibility that we might, like you're saying, start to see that beneath the surface, whether with a child or whether an adult. This is the distinction he's trying to undo. That is the one that I really appreciate, is that there is a way of seeing people that appreciates that very often how someone behaves is not ill intent towards us. Like, we project great complex worlds of story onto someone, and we so easily make child or adult how they're behaving towards us about me, like, you're doing this to me and you must be doing this to me because blah blah blah, you know, the 50 million reasons I can think of why you've got it in for me. And once I'm sure about that kind of story, then of course what I'm reacting to is my own projection onto another person, not to the person themselves. And so what this piece asks us to do, I think, is to start to wonder what might it be that is behind the bluster, what might it be that's behind the story. And of course there are lots of different interpretations of that than the one that Alan brings us as well. Like, you might come at the world thinking everyone really is out to get me, that's what's behind, which leads to a particularly small, pained, contracted, distant way of relating. One of the things I really am really taken by what you said, Lizzie, is what happens when we come at this as practice ground, because it's a different way of talking from asking ourselves to believe something like it's an item of dogma. So if we just believed that everybody was sweet and kind and hurt behind the surface, then everything would be fine. And the problem with that is it's a kind of rigidity as well, because sometimes, you know, sometimes somebody does have it in for me. Sometimes it's right and appropriate to see that there's, for one reason or another, there's ill intent my way. And so to have some kind of dogma about it, I think, doesn't help. But instead, coming at this in a way sort of experimentally, which is what happens if we start to look at other people, other adults and other children, as if they were basically good and in difficulty and in pain. We could wonder, if we start to do that, what it starts to open up. And the first thing, it seems to me, at least in my own experience, that opens up is that when I remember to come at life this way, is I let go, like the clenched fist inside my chest, which is where I end up when I'm frightened, or usually when I'm frightened, or yes, whether I'm frightened of another person or if I'm frightened of myself. So I think this is the equal thing for me, like I'm frightened about what will happen if I allow myself to be vulnerable, or allow myself to, my hurt to be exposed. If I practice remembering that there's something sweet and good about being a human being, that's true of me and true of the other person, and that we're all hurting, this clenched fist starts to relax. And then very often I find that I can be a come back into relationship then, rather than being in harsh judgment, usually of myself and the other person. And practice ground is such a lovely way of talking about it, because then it's not something that we have to I have to remember every time and get right every time. It's more like, oh, here's another opportunity to practice a kind of kindness and truthfulness. That one of the things I heard you say, Lizzie, was that can start with the people who are right in closest, that's the place to begin our practice, and then it's possible to extend it and extend it and extend it as we go.
Yeah. As you were talking, Justin, I was coming up, going through all the people in my life that I have some kind of judgment on or an issue with, and feeling into how I work with it. And I'm noticing that one of the ways that I try and practice and often fail is to see the good intention in people, just as a kind of beginner move of the relaxation you're talking about, of the unclenching happening, and to look at someone's actions and say, well, there must be always a way to see what someone's intention is, and to keep digging until we can find a... It's not hard, as what I found anyway, to find a good intention. Like, even if a good intention is expressing my anger, like there's goodness in that. It's a necessary part of being a person, is to express oneself, and it might be being done badly, but there's still a kernel of goodness in there something's trying to be brought into the world. If someone's angry, or if somebody's feeling judgmental, it might be that they're trying to protect something, or it seems to me like that's a way to begin, is to recognize the goodness, even if it feels like you can barely see it. And I feel like if I can see the goodness, it's a way that I can also cultivate some safety, because if I'm triggered and feeling unsafe and defended, and so are you, neither of us are feeling particularly safe. So what can I do to generate some safety that we could let down our defenses? And maybe that might work, and maybe it might not, in terms of letting that clenching down a little on behalf of both people in the dynamic, or even the whole group. But I think it's an important, brave, and necessary move to wonder about what would have us feel safe, so that we didn't have to be so defended, and what my part in that might be. Like, I might not be able to do all the work, but I could do some of the work. I could appreciate someone. I could say, I really understand how come that just happened, even if it's to myself, in my own mind, so that I can find a different level on which to connect, rather than a superficial one, a bluster generated response, versus a kind of a deeper kind of response to something or someone and their actions or their speaking. And even as I'm saying it, I can feel myself responding slightly differently to even some things I've been in just these last days. And by the way, in my life, this can happen on WhatsApp. You know what I mean? It's not like I have to be at like a Christmas dinner or something. This is just like a comment that someone makes, and I go, oh, my goodness, that's really hurtful. Or, I'm just thinking of a family WhatsApp we have, and someone said something, and I haven't responded, and I thought, I don't know why. Why they said that, and they must be really insensitive. And now, as I'm sitting here, I can settle and go, well, I can feel that that wasn't really actually about me or about them. It's just a thing, and it's WhatsApp, and it's, So I think there's so many opportunities to settle in and go a little bit of a different route. And this kind of seeing the good intention and how that gets kind of twisted about through my interpretation and through defensiveness and protectiveness and all the ways that we're trying to get through this life intact somehow, with maybe a mistaken understanding of what it takes to do that.
I love what you're saying. It's got a bit windy here and I've had to move because a whole unexpected crowd of people just came out of a building to sit right next to me. Great big team of people from the beach. So I've moved over. Is this okay, Lizzie, with sound?
Yes, don't put your hand over it and it's better.
If I don't put it, it's better. Okay, so of course I can't hear. I'm really taken by what you say about safety. And there's a part in what Alan de Botton has written here, where he says, you know, what if we put aside the worst of our compulsions, vindictiveness and fury, and also we demand a little less than we normally do, and we slow down our anger and get a bit more aware of unrealized potential. And it reminds me that very often what's going on that has our relationships with other people feel unsafe, whether they're people in close or work colleagues or whatever, is we have such we can easily have such high demands of ourselves and other people, like you have to be this way with me, you cannot be, the moment you show any anger or irritation with me, something terrible is going on, or we have the same demands of ourselves. And we stop treating one another like unfinished things. You know, if we really got, I think this is the thing that's really sweet about what Alan has written here, is that when we get that we're all incomplete, that we're works in progress, we can make it a little bit safer for us to be messy. And in a way, I think that's the trap that I'm realizing as we're talking, is that when we don't allow ourselves to be messy, incomplete people who have longings and hurts and needs and make mistakes and very often don't know exactly what we're doing because we're swept over by strong emotions, when we demand of other people that they're not like that, and of course demand that of ourselves, then we're really stuck. And then of course it is unsafe. It's unsafe for me to show anything to you because I don't then fit the very narrow, you know, bounds of how you're meant to be. And somehow we get into this quite easily. Maybe one of the reasons, Lizzie, that we you know, when you were talking about the difference between often how we treat people who are in close and then when someone comes to the door and we get all socialized and polite and all of this kind of things. But maybe one of the reasons that we treat people in close in this way is because that's exactly the place where we've built up a whole set of expectations about how someone should be because we know them. And we're willing to cut some slack, ourselves some slack, and other people some slack when they come to the door and go, let's just put all of that aside. And sort of, so in one way, the politeness there is a kind of constraint, but in another way, we're able to do it because we find in ourselves the part that can relax and to go, okay, I'm not going to treat you as if you're a demon out to get me. And I'm going to give you some leeway for being, I don't know what. Yeah, so all of that. And I love this idea distinction that you brought in, that what we could do is to practice making it safe for one another to be human. That would be such a wonderful thing to practice. Can I let myself off the hook for being a human, and can I let you off the hook for being a human? And then we can be messy and incomplete and trust that there might be some other things other than the stories that we have about one another that are at play here.
Yeah. And as you're speaking, Justin, I'm feeling into the fact that, you know, maybe one of the reasons that we are, you know, less, I don't know what the word is, like less kind, maybe, or less respectful or whatever to the people closest to us is because they're the people that we feel the safest with as well. And so all kinds of things come out, and then we have to get into the conversation about accountability and being responsible and feeling things but not hurting people with the way we feel, and gets into a whole other, I think, deeper conversation about what it means to be in relationship that's deep and to still call on our kindness even though we feel in some way safe to be whatever we want to be, it doesn't mean that the people around us need to have to take that from us. And anyway, that's a huge, huge thing, but I think it's all kind of linked in with everything. But I love this invitation for us to use one another as practice grounds for finding good intention and finding what's beneath the bluster, and to keep committed to that, because it's so easy to kind of fall out of that way of feeling and seeing and experiencing the world. So I really appreciate this conversation.
Well, this is like, I want to end with something you taught me that I really appreciated. That is where my coming in by drawing attention to the bluster came from, is to remember that so often of what we take to be a specific thing directed our way is just really a cover up for vulnerability. And I remember once Lizzie and me being in quite some significant difficulty with another person, and you saying, yeah, but remember, see if when you're with them, you can remember that they were once a very sweet baby with none of this going on, with no hurts yet and no stories yet and no history. Can you find that in them, even in the midst of all of the other stuff that is difficult and distasteful and frightening and confusing? Can you find that? And in a way, for me, that was why this very source came my way, is because I know that when I've been able to do that, something else starts to emerge, as well as my certainty that things are this particular way. And in a way, I think that's very often what these sources that we're bringing and these conversations that we're bringing do, is remind us that there's another way. There's always another way to see things.
Yeah.
And sometimes the other way to see things can open up possibilities that are life-giving, that were not present before. And like you say, we practice our way into it.
Mm.
So I'm very appreciative for this chance to practice together by talking and seeing if we can find out what's true. And for all of you who are listening with us, you'll know, because we've said this so many times, this of course is a real inquiry between us, an unrehearsed let's find our way from something. And I'm thrilled that we've been able to do this from the beach in different parts of the world. It's quite an extraordinary thing. So it's time for us to end. I want to say thank you to everyone for joining us. We will greatly look forward to being with you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.